This episode of The Python Perspective is brought to you by Confuse-A-Cat Incorporated. If you need to shake your cat out of a sense of complacency to counteract the doldrums of fin de siècle ennui...
Well, I think I can definitely say that your cat badly needs to be confused.
What?
Shh! What?
Confused. To shake it out of its state of complacency.
Contact the experts at Confuse-A-Cat.
Right, men. Confuse the... cat.
Incorporated with Amaze of Ol, Stonestoat, Puzzle of Puma, Startle of Thompson's Gazelle, Bewildered Beast Incorporated, and Distract-A-Bee. Welcome to the Python Perspective. Since its premiere in October 1969, Monty Python's Flying Circus has induced alienation and devotion, culminating in 2014 with what was announced as 10 final live performances in the 16,000-seat O2 Arena. On the 50th anniversary of each original television broadcast, we look back at the series and ask, what was innovative material then, what continues to be successful now, and what have people thought about it along the way? I'm Ben, librarian and critic, and joining me is my co-host Nathan, physicist, improv comedian, and actor.
Good day to you, Ben.
Good day, Nathan. As anybody who has listened to our last episodes is aware, we're recording these slightly in advance. Today is actually in early September. This is a Python anniversary for me, personally, today. It is the 12th anniversary of my having a chance to see Michael Palin live when he did a book tour for the first of his volume of diaries. He came to Cambridge, Massachusetts 12 years ago today in the First Church and did a live reading and an autograph session afterwards. So this is a real Python reunion for me when we're recording, in addition to it being a Python anniversary for the episode in the date of this release.
That's really cool. That was one of his travel sessions, travel produced book tours.
Yeah, you sent me a marvelous photograph of you heading across a piazza in Italy and just randomly tripping across him filming one of his travel shows.
Yeah, where was it? I was in Siena, Italy, being a tourist by myself because that's what I do. And there he was, like in the middle of the piazza with him. He had a small production team. And the funniest thing about that was there is this whole enclave of Japanese tourists who were walking by him having no idea who he was. They all had these huge cameras and they were taking pictures of things they ought to be taking pictures of, like the buildings and the square and just the sheer beauty of Siena, Italy. And he was just kind of looking a little sheepish, like his big camera on him. Like, what am I supposed to do? And I wanted to go up and talk to him, but I got as far as his producer. And just asked, like, what's Michael doing? And she was like,
well, he's giving a tour of Siena, Italy. Thank you very much. Carry on.
So while all the tourists were taking pictures of the Duomo in the square, you took a picture of a little white man.
That's right.
Feel free to look at our social media if I'm able to convince Nathan to allow me to share his amateur 35mm print of that, which I actually have ready to hand in order to scan and upload if he gives me his permission. It'll be on our media, and you can check it out.
I think I gave you a copy of one, didn't I? Yeah.
I have all of my photographs of our various Python excursions in one place, so I know where the three Pythons that we've seen in person, I know where our evidence is.
That is not true. We've seen four.
Okay. We've seen Eric Idle in Pittsburgh.
In Pittsburgh.
We've seen John Cleese in Ithaca.
Yep.
We've seen Terry Jones in Chicago.
Yeah.
What am I forgetting?
Okay, so you mean like together we've seen them.
Yes, yes.
Oh, sorry.
You've seen Palin individually and I've seen Palin individually and we've... neither of us has yet to track down Gilliam.
Well, Gilliam, interestingly enough, doesn't live in this country anymore. He lives in somewhere in Milan or Naples or something, somewhere in Italy. He's now an Italian citizen. And so I think his appearances in the U.S. would be heavily marketed as a tour, where it should be very hard to see him because he's probably in Los Angeles or something, or New York.
When The Man Who Killed Don Quixote came out, I was hoping that he would do some sort of mini press tour or screening tour of it. Occasionally those come to Boston and I'm I've been lucky enough to have an opportunity to see some pretty great filmmakers in Q&As because of my proximity there. Gilliam has yet to do that in Boston specifically. He hasn't needed to do press appearances in that small of a location, but I figure one of these days it'll happen.
Hopefully it'll happen.
So, in 1969, episode 5, Man's Crisis of Identity in the Latter Half of the 20th Century, was aired on BBC on this fine October evening, beginning once again with the It's Man. And if I'm not mistaken...
Correction, it was broadcast in November, not October.
Oh my gosh, yes, you're right. So, 50 years ago today, on November 16th, 1969.
There we go.
A few weeks after episode 5 was recorded, if you tuned into our mini-sode about the two-week hiatus, you'll be up on all the deets about that. And after the It's Man rows in with his dinghy, is this the first appearance of John Cleese doing the intro of Monty Python's Flying Circus in a different voice than his newsreader tone?
Monty Python's Flying Circus!
Yes, he has a... I just classify it as silly dumb. There are a couple of different uses of his voice to get a different kind of feel. Mm-hmm. And each... The first four episodes, the feel was very erudite and smart. But it kind of changes. And I don't know what brought on that change, if he just felt inspired after being not broadcast for 2 weeks to just change it up or what. But this one is a little bit more silly dumb. But otherwise, the opening is the same. There is still no fart noise when the foot comes down. It is the same cartoons.
Yeah, I don't believe the animations change except for each season. I would assume that the amount of work that goes into doing that would be prohibitive for him to create new animation links and alter the animated titles every week.
Yeah, that makes sense.
I like your inference that there was something about coming back that made them feel that the initial tone that they needed to set in terms of the contrast between the silly titles and the staid professional voice, that they could get away from that and also have a silly voice better befitting the tone of the content of the show, that was something they were able to do now that they were back from break.
It's interesting to note that the It's Man, it's only a 10-second delay now.
Mm.
He rose in, footage is clearly much faster than it was filmed at. But it's only 10 seconds, whereas before it was almost a minute. So that is an interesting thought. That is that something that they were kind of pressured into, or they just did it because the show itself was too long and they had to cut it down? Or
right,
they just felt like, okay, we've run this joke, let's not make the audience sit through another minute.
Similarly, at the end credits, when the It's Man rows back away, again, to sped up footage, it's 29 seconds long. You get a very brief, quite speedy end credits and not an extended feeling of we're milking this for jokes. It's a little bit more perfunctory. So speaking of the sped up footage of the It's Man in the boat, a couple of times in our previous episodes, Nathan, you've brought up the idea of the inherent humorous quality of sped up footage. When we talked about the way in which Mr. F.G. Superman walked when he had transformed into Bicycle Repairman, and in, I believe specifically, the trying to get undressed sketch that Terry Jones did by the seaside. You mentioned that you felt that there was something about faster than normal footage that we found funny just because it was sped up. Do I remember that incorrectly?
That is correct. Yeah, there's something funny about the robotic nature of sped up footage.
I was looking a little bit into the idea of old silent film because of a note that's going to come up later in this episode, depending on what we talk about. There is a different frame rate that was used in cameras in early film versus what we ended up using, the 24 frames per second.
Mm-hmm.
And so a lot of silent films were shot, I believe, in either 16 or 18 frames per second. And so therefore, naturally, were sped up when screened afterwards. But what I found more potentially interesting is a couple of years ago, there was a study about whether or not infants could tell that there were natural laws of physics in the world. I have an article in front of me from 2015 in The Independent with the headline, "Babies are born with a grasp of physics," researchers claim. They had infants less than a year old watch footage of objects falling or breaking, and then they would play the footage of those same physical actions in reverse. And obviously, infants don't have the ability to talk, so their ability to say, "Oh yes, well, that's very clearly the conservation of thermodynamics," and you can see there the way in which the glass can't come back together. But they...
Where's my quantum theory?
The basic premise was that babies would pay more attention to the footage that was shown in reverse, indicating that they were surprised or attracted to it because it wasn't what they saw in the natural world. And which led the researchers to believe that there was an awareness, even in less than a year old, as to how the world works, how the natural physical world operates. Which leads me to believe that there might just be something about sped up motion, because we're aware on an instinctive level that it's wrong, that makes us say that's it. Well, it would either be, we'd have to be like Uncanny Valley. "That's wrong. How dare people be shown moving in a way that is unnatural?" Or we'd have to laugh at it. So that's my theory, belonging to me, that I came up with just based on remembering that article. If you were to give it the old smell test, what do you think?
There's something to it, but I would add on that there's nothing inherently funny about watching, for example, footage of a river sped up. You know it's faster because the water moves faster. Or seeing a tape. For some reason, I have a lot of family videos of me as a kid and my brother and sister on the beach, and like waves would come in much faster than like maybe like 1.8 to 2x. For whatever reason, the transfer from 8mm to video was wrong or something like that. But that is not itself funny. The funny part comes with the cognitive dissonance when you look at a human do it. You know that that's impossible. So there's something unnatural about something so natural as a human that you're so intimately familiar with, that that is where the humor comes. It's not necessarily things sped up per se. Like you're a human 24/7 and you know how fast you move. So seeing something move faster, that just is what causes your brain to look a little odd at it. We're built evolutionarily to understand the mechanics of our own bodies. And when suddenly we're posed with a visual representation, which is something which is breaking that boundary, that rule, that natural law, as it were, that's what makes us kind of go, "Huh, that's odd." That's about as deep as I can go.
I like it. It also, it sort of sounds like it might be the basis for a universal theory of the appeal of animation, because you have representations of humans but that are clearly not human, and so therefore part of the appeal is that they can do things or act in manners that are representative but not accurate, and therefore that would prove enjoyable.
Just think of how boring it would be to see Wile E. Coyote run at actual human speed. Just only because I recently saw it, there is, my wife and I were watching Buffy the Vampire Slayer, and there's this really fantastic episode, which is a musical.
Yes.
And there's one scene in that musical where one actor is singing at 1x, but the character, so that's Giles, he's singing at 1x, and the character he's singing to, Buffy, is being played, she's filmed on a green screen, and her motion is slowed down. So she's going at about half speed. It almost has the opposite effect, where everything becomes much more serious. But it is interesting to note that slower does not lend itself to humor, at least in that one particular example.
It lends more import to her actions.
Yeah.
Huh, I like it. Well, transitioning off of tangents and focusing back in on our purpose and focus of the podcast, let's talk first, as we always do, about our three favorite sketches. And I'm going to continue to try and say sketches and not skits. I swear to you, the listener, I am working on it. So, Nathan.
Although we have both said skitches.
Yes.
I know, because I listened to the audio. We both said skitches. I left mine in there, but I took yours out because you drew too much attention to it.
Yeah, I say it a lot. Sketches. The sketches. Nathan, what is one of your three favorite sketches for the fifth episode, Man's Crisis of Identity?
Well, it was brought up already, but I'm going to say Confuse the Cat.
Well, it is, I think, the heart of the episode. Not only is it the first sketch that we have in the show, but also it's a solid 7 minutes long, proportionally much more involved and, in terms of time, real estate in the episode, significant. What about it appeals?
There are several things. We had mentioned on previous episodes of this podcast that there's something that I like about a communal effort from all the Pythons contributing to a sketch. And this definitely has that feel. There's a filmed on location bit at the end, and it starts off with a studio taped portion of the sketch. And the two feel very Cleese Chapman-y versus Jones Palin-y. Mm. And the marriage of those two, I do like that. I do like that they're all kind of coming together to make one idea pan out. One of my favorite moments actually is from the Graham Chapman performance. I think he is a ridiculously good, serious-minded doctor type, and I enjoy watching him do that.
He gets a laugh just from showing up at the beginning of the sketch. Walking on as a serious-faced doctor, the audience already is appreciative of the amount of grim determination that he's bringing to this character of a veterinarian.
Yeah, there's something about his tone, and he likes listing off things. It's a very good example of what makes a Cleese and Chapman sketch, is that they like to list off things under some category. In this case, it's basically feeling down. And he has a whole list of...
It's the old stockbroker syndrome. The suburban fin de siècle ennui. Angst, Weltschmerz, call it what you will.
Things which I did not know. Some I didn't even know what they were and had to look them up, but they're all basically synonyms of the same thing. Mm. I do like that aspect. But then we were talking about how babies respond to things that don't seem physically real.
Yes.
I was reminded of that very thing when watching the Confuse the Cat sketch, because that is exactly what they do to the cat.
Right.
They assemble some portable stage.
Oh, move, move, move! Get those funny things up!
And they have a one-angle shot of all these actors on stage doing things, but the way it's edited, things are basically impossible. People disappear, people move on their own, they jump up into the sky, they explode each other. It's a very fun bit of film. It's almost 2 minutes long, so it's a long segment. Mm-hmm. Again, with no words, but purely physical, kind of forced physical humor. And I feel like the baby. I watch it. It's like, well, none of this makes any sense. And I'm just kind of sitting there confused. I'm like the cat, too.
Yeah, we're going to get unsubscribes from this, but I'd say, you know, an 11th-year-old infant, a cat, are about the same level of intellect, and therefore, you know, if something can excite a baby, it can definitely confuse a cat.
That's all I can really say about it.
Well, I've got a bunch of stuff to say about this.
Yeah, that's what I thought. So I had to get mine out early so you wouldn't overtalk me and bury me with your words.
Curse you. So, first of all, just a history of the film technique that's used in the Confuse the Cat thing. You mentioned that the camera is operating from a one-shot fixed position, which is necessary for the kind of cutting that you do over the course of the Confuse the Cat montage. If you're going to be using what's called a substitution splice, where you cut the camera and then alter things, whether it's the different hats that the boxers are using or the presence of the moving of the trash can so that it seems to be moving on its own. Stop motion animation is done by using substitution splices, and so are early special effects. Wikipedia tells me that George Melies may have used the first substitution splice in 1896 in a short film called Vanishing Lady. I beg your pardon. Wikipedia corrects that. That is often attributed, but Wikipedia says that the first use was done a year earlier in 1895 in a film called The Execution of the Queen of Scots that was made by Einstein Films, wherein a live woman puts her head on the execution block, and then as the axe cuts down, there's a substitution for a dummy, which is then has its head severed. I particularly wanted to mention this because, obviously, Monty Python revisits the concept of the death of Mary Queen of Scots in Season 2, Episode 9, with a very wonderful radio play dramatizing her death. The film itself, the strange cutting, the opportunities to use classic film techniques, is largely attributed to be an homage to a film that was made by Richard Lester. Richard Lester, who worked with the Beatles on A Hard Day's Night, made a short film called The Running, Jumping, and Standing Still Film in 1959, with members of the Goon Show. Both Peter Sellers and Spike Milligan appear in the film. And what's fascinating about it is, despite the fact that it is often referred to as a heavy influence on Python, this film, which is currently showing on the Criterion Channel because of the Richard Lester connection, is actually quite dull. It's mostly an exercise in a series of cuts that make it seem like it's all one shot, so therefore it's a harbinger of Birdman or the Unexpected Virtue of Ignorance, where they used cutting techniques to digitally have the whole thing be one shot despite not actually filmed that way. But it's very quiet and very quaint, and it doesn't have the kind of silly stop-motion antics that you associate with The Beatles in A Hard Day's Night, but which I think are actually more used in The Monkees when they were satirizing that kind of technique and therefore exploding it into their television show. I think it's a weirdly backwards perspective thing that isn't actually as frequent as we think it is. I don't know if that makes any sense.
I don't know that I've ever seen Hard Day's Night.
Okay.
I have seen The Monkees. But at the time I've watched The Monkees, I was too naive to know what its significance. That it was essentially, it was an also ran on the idea that, hey, bands can have TV shows and that can make money. And just toss one British guy in there and they're all British. But it definitely felt more of a, more of a sitcom, I guess.
It was.
But all this is stuff I learned, you know, decades later. I've never seen the Running, Jumping, Standing Still film, but it's interesting to note that there's a progenitor for the Confuse the Cat film part that they drew upon, even within that British comedy writing community. Peter Sellers was definitely in there, as was some of the other guys you mentioned.
Spike Milligan. Yeah, all of the Pythons at one time or another have, well, except for Gilliam, have talked about how important growing up listening to Goon Show was. And when Spike Milligan's television show had started, Chapman and Cleese have specifically said that there were things that were going on that show that both made them feel like they had a license to be as silly as they wanted to in Monty Python's Flying Circus, but also which they would shake their fist at the television and say, damn it, that was something we were going to do and now we can't do it.
It's interesting that you bring that up, though. I was going to segue to something else if you have more.
Please, go nuts. I talked for a while.
It's interesting that we were talking about things that came before as influential on things that were put on Monty Python's Flying Circus, because as far as I can tell, this is one of the first, maybe the only time where they have pilfered from themselves and then reshot an already broadcast bit.
Okay.
For Monty Python's Flying Circus. And that sketch is the silly job interview, which is essentially taken verbatim from John Cleese's How to Irritate People, produced almost a year earlier with a slightly different cast.
You know, I really enjoy interviewing applicants for this management training course. Go in.
But it essentially was written for another show, produced and broadcast in that other show, and then reappropriated, reshot as a Monty Python bit. They will do this later on in the live shows. They will take from Last the 1948 show. So there's like The Four Yorkshiremen, for example, is a sketch which comes from At Last the 1948 show. Bookshop sketch appears on their audio, their LPs. History of Comedy, probably our founding Monty Python experience.
Yeah. We
performed that in high school. Those are all done in pre-Python shows, but were then reused and sort of rebranded as Python for much later on. But the silly interview was done in the actual 1969 broadcast.
Was Graham Chapman the interviewed client in the original How to Irritate People sketch?
Tell me, why do you say good morning when you know perfectly well that it's afternoon?
Well, you said good morning.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Oh, dear.
He was not. It was Timbrook Taylor.
Okay. That's interesting. Let's talk about the management training course sketch for a second. Sketch. I did it.
You did it again. For some reason, that brings back a memory of a Peanuts cartoon where Linus is trying to pet Snoopy and the words say, scratch, scratch, scratch. And you can see Snoopy's like trying to like get away, and Charlie Brown turns to Linus and he says, no, he doesn't like to be scratched, he likes to be scritched. Scritched. And Charlie Brown says, see? And he reaches out his hand, and now the words say scritch, 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 and Snoopy is just smiling, and he's just all in love with that. So, you know.
I love it.
Potato, potato.
So, in the management training course, Scritch, we have this sense that I'm glad that you brought the fact up, because I really did feel like how to irritate people in its tone. But it also lends credence to the idea that you thought that perhaps this episode was running potentially off in terms of its timing when you talked about the It's Man at the beginning of the end. In order to keep the sketch intact, I wonder if there was a timing issue there. That's fascinating that they did reuse it, especially with a broadcast sketch. I'm mostly just prevaricating now.
Good evening. Goodbye.
No.
I mean, it's an interesting question because it could be a couple of different things.
Yeah.
It could be that they just needed something in short order and Cleese is like, I can bring it up. Mm-hmm. Chapman knows all the lines. Boom. Just bring in three extras. You're done. Could be that he put his foot down and said, this is my show, remember.
Mm.
You're here because of me. I can do what I want. Seems a little less likely. Or things were not recorded so that people could watch them whenever the hell they wanted to. So he's like, yeah, I broadcast this a year ago, but no one's going to remember.
That's an excellent point. The availability of a rebroadcast, while some of the shows were followed up on, you would have a rebroadcast of Monty Python a couple of days later, frequently, depending on what territory you were in, because the BBC wasn't a monolith. London would broadcast it, and then the surrounding local BBC outposts would have the option of changing the timing or schedule or rebroadcasting in order to fill out certain material. That having not seen it the first time, maybe they did feel that it was something that a lot of people just simply wouldn't know.
Yeah, I'm not sure of that.
I love it as an operating theory.
I mean, even in the live shows, mm-hmm. once they started getting more and more famous and then, you know, dollar signs became, or pound signs, pound sterling became things that they could like, oh my God, we can make money. I think that they were hesitant to draw upon material that was not guaranteed laughs, and that they're all too happy to turn to stuff that they had done before Python and then kind of rebranded as Python.
For the 40th anniversary of Python, there was a major event in New York City that some of the Pythons appeared on, and contemporaneous with that, a group of comedians, including Jeff Davis and Jane Leaves, did a couple live performances of Python sketches in New York for an audience, and they finished with the History of Jape sketch, which I had an opportunity to see and was so excited because I do feel that it's a great moment to incorporate a large number of players on stage. There aren't that many stage-worthy shows that allow the full cast to be there. I think one of the other good ones for that is the Bruce's Philosopher song. It allows you to have everybody there. And the four members of the Four Yorkshiremen, similarly, it gives you a good core group of people to all act together. There aren't that many sketches that do that. I think a lot of the sketches that we enjoy that have all the Pythons involved in both the writing and the performing are not good traveling show sketches, whereas History of Jape was fantastic for that.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting, therefore, that it was the closing sketch for a Monty Python 40th reunion, and it wasn't even originally a Python sketch. Does the management training course sketch enter into your top three? Is it one of the things that stood out for you in the episode?
It does not. Not for the reason I just said that it's not strictly a Python original. Just other ones, edge it out. In general, that sketch, the word cringeworthy comes up in my kind of overall summary of that sketch. You kind of feel bad that this interviewee is just getting harassed.
Yeah.
Aren't you going to ask me why I rang the bell?
Why did you ring the bell?
Why do you think I rang the bell? What? 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0.
Well, I'm too late.
And I do say that I do think that Chapman plays it very well as a sort of a straight man, but I don't know. It doesn't fall to the top of the bucket. You know, that doesn't make any sense gravitationally, but you know, it doesn't come into my top three.
I think that's fair. As somebody who doesn't enjoy cringe humor, I have enjoyed Cleese's performance as a slimy, nasty man who's abusing his power. I think he leans into doing the judgmental, slick nastiness towards Graham's character very well. And I will say, the sound of him saying, good night, ding, 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 has stayed with me for a very long time. It has a certain creepiness to it that is lovely. But in general, I wouldn't be hard-pressed to name any cringe humor in a top three. I prefer to have something that's more joyous or more founded in non sequitur, which I think are my primary modes of laughter. So what what's number two for you then?
Right. Number two is letters and vox pops on class and culture. So there are two vox pop segments in this episode. One is on smuggling, and the other one is on class and cultural attitudes of the time. And so this one is the latter. It starts off as essentially a linking segment after one sketch on smuggling.
So both of them begin like they're going to be linking segments. The first one follows on from the customs agent with Michael Palin trying to smuggle in watches from Switzerland. And then in the middle of the two vox pops, we have the raid with Graham Chapman's police officer accosting and planting drugs on Eric Idle's character. And then we have further vox pops after that.
This is another example of how the Pythons have come up with a new way of linking sketches together.
Mm-hmm.
We talked a lot in episode 4, Al Stretching Time, about the colonel comes in, inserts himself in sketches, sort of cut him off prematurely. Well, now we have written letters and just the film is of a written letter and someone is dictating it. That in itself serves as a cut to introduce a new idea. So the police raid where Chapman comes in, essentially plants what he thinks are drugs in Eric Idle's living room, but in fact become sandwiches.
Sandwiches?
Sandwiches?
Ends with a very obvious punchline.
Blimey, whatever did I give the wife?
But then the cut is within maybe 10 milliseconds. The audience doesn't even have a chance to laugh before you have the film of a letter and Kara Cleveland's voice talking over.
Dear BBC, East Grinstead, Friday. I feel I really must write and protest about that sketch.
And you can even hear in the audio that they didn't get the laugh immediately because they wanted the cut to be very fast, but the laugh is like, there's no laughter. Chapman says his line and then it cuts and the laughter is like peaked and then it drops away. So they had to make a cut so that the visual was cutting away from the joke. There was some pretty severe audio discontinuity.
Blimey, whatever did I give the wife?
Dear BBC, East Grinstead, Friday.
But it does introduce a new linking segment where you're basically dictating a letter. And from that into the vox pops on cultural norms, I find that all to be really just delicious to listen to.
I will say the basic premise of the show receiving critical letters about a sketch that's just aired is pretty lovely. That it's obviously farcical. It's obviously impossible that somebody could have already written in to say, how dare the BBC pollute my airwaves with something this disastrous? But at the same time, the practice of having an opportunity for the public to respond to content of the BBC had already been well established. This was a legitimate thing that the BBC did, often for 3 to 5 minutes at a time at the end of a show before a new show started, in order to make the audience feel involved and pertinent, they would read out letters from audience members about whether or not they thought BBC was doing its job as a government organ.
The second letter writes in to complain about the first letter.
Right!
As a prolific letter writer, I feel I must protest about the previous letter.
And this is a technique that they will use in future episodes, but its first appearance is right now. The first letter actually doesn't really make any real complaint about anything. I think the content is something like,
my husband, in common with a lot of people of his age, is 50.
How long do you have to keep on going accepting these things? What I like about the second letter, which is a John Cleese voiceover, is it's definitely poking at, I think, the people who would write in to complain about the actual show. Even though the letter on the actual Monty Python's Flying Circus episode is complaining about the previous letter, they bring in like a little bit of, is the word senility the noun form of senile?
Senility.
Senility. A little bit of not all cylinders firing at once.
The vox pop isn't compos mentis.
There's a random capitalization, a lot of nonsense messages. Then Cleese's letter rambles into like generational attributes.
Yes.
World War II versus the modern hippies.
If this continues to go on unabated, Dunkirk, dark days of the war, backs to the wall, Alva Liddell, Berlin airlift, moral upheaval, a perfume case, young hippies roaming the streets, raping, looting, and killing.
Then he brings up other things that I had no idea what they were, but Alvar Liddell was a BBC radio announcer during World War II. Perfuma Case was a British politician who had a sex scandal with a, I believe, 16-year-old Italian model, or model of some nationality, I forget. There would be so many parallels we could link to today, but it's basically making a political point that I'm a person of a certain age where things like, oh, the good old days of the war when we won are still fresh in their memories, and that's what's most important to them. And this new TV show, which is breaking the norms, is what I'm writing a letter about.
And the fact that he's so incensed about this generational divide that it ceases to become an actual logical series of thoughts about the moral decline, but just is a checklist of the sort of things that people would use as the basis for pointing out why everything's gone to the dogs, with just ellipses between them.
It's why we're the greatest generation, of course. Dark Days of the War, Backs to the Wall.
Dunkirk, Berlin Airlift. And then it ends with...
Yours, etc., Brigadier Arthur Gormanstrop, Mrs.
The whole letter has been read by John Cleese. And then the twist at the end is that it's the Brigadier's wife who's been writing this letter in her moral outrage. The audience goes nuts. The audience laughs like a drain over that simple word "missus" at the end after having been listening to Cleese's rich baritone for the entire letter. The Pythons will get a reasonable amount of stick for the amount of times that they have men dressed as women instead of using women as women's parts, and there will be questions about their portrayal of cross-dressing as something that is laughable. But the audience also finds the simple gender reversal here to be the funniest thing in the whole show. That, ha ha! We thought it was a man, but it's a woman! So as difficult as it may be from our modern perspective to look at some of the cross-dressing without cringing and say, oh yeah, that wouldn't hold up today, I say that tiny element shows that it was very much the sort of sense of humor that was applicable for the time period.
The next four filmed bits in the actual Vox Pops, two of them are cross-dressers.
Mm.
It is Eric Idle as lower-class cigarette-smoking pepper pot. And there's almost the exact opposite of that of Terry Jones as a kind of a academic modern feminist. I had to watch this a few times, but it's definitely a satirical tone.
Mm-hmm.
But they kind of make fun of everybody. Lower-class, high-class, progressive, conservative. Even the sort of do as I say, not as I do, patriarchal, you're just a brick in the wall kind of British school system, I guess, when Michael Palin, as a child...
I think there should be more race prejudice. Less. Less race prejudice.
I think he's wearing a Boy Scout uniform at the time, so it even has that additional creepy vibe of the older scoutmaster setting him straight with his head at crotch level. I don't think it's intentional, but it's one of those things that makes me vaguely uncomfortable with the unconscious symbolism. I agree. I think part of the point of the Vox Pops would be in real life, when the BBC would go out and try to get the opinion of the man on the street.
Let's ask the man in the street what he thinks.
I am not a man, you silly Billy.
I'm not in the street, you fairy!
They would probably work hard in order to have a certain degree of representation. That they would want to have old and young, male and female, different parts of the country weighing in.
Well, that's very interesting, because I am in fact made entirely of wood.
And so to have a pepper pot and a journalist and a Scotsman and a stockbroker would be a satire of the kind of four-quadrant representation that the BBC would have been working hard for.
For some reason, seeing that boxer come in and strike Terry Jones as the contemporary feminist elite?
Yeah.
Well, I think they should attack the funny-duddy attitudes of the lower middle classes, which permit the establishment to survive and keep the mores of the whole country back where they were in the 19th century and the ghastly days of the pre-sexual revolution.
I like that. She's making a genuine argument. She's making an argument which to a modern audience does ring true.
Mm-hmm.
But then the fact that she gets punched out by the
decidedly
non-muscular, half-naked Eric Idle. It's also just, it's funny.
And it's the only callback to the Confuse-a-Cat sketch.
So my third favorite sketch is The Newsreader Arrested.
In Fulham this morning, a jeweller's shop was broken into and jewellery to the value of £2,000 stolen. Police have issued this picture of a man they wish to interview.
I want to say this is written by Eric Idle. It has a Idle-esque feel to it, and he is the main star. And usually that is a good indicator that he wrote it. Because with the internal competition amongst all the writing members, it's better for them to be on screen if they wrote it for themselves. Usually how it worked.
Similarly, Idle has talked about the fact that because there were established writing partner relationships or evolving writing partner relationships, Jones and Palin would work together and Cleese and Chapman would work together. And so Idle would write mostly on his own. And when they would do reading sessions, then they'd come together and share their material. There would obviously be collaboration and punch up then, but he mostly wrote his stuff by himself. And so if there's a basically one person sketch starring Idle, featuring Idle, focusing on Idle, he probably wrote it.
I want to point out this sketch is less than a minute.
Mm.
It is very quick, not long drawn out at all. It's a very clear, straightforward joke, but it progresses so quickly that you never get bored with it. Even though you kind of sense where it's going to go, it always seems like it's fresh and unexpected because it cuts so fast. To my eye, there are four parts.
Okay.
The first part, which is only 15 seconds, is when the joke is basically revealed. Eric Idle's reading the news, and he says, there's a jewelry thief, and this is a picture of a man. It's a picture of himself in the same chair, at the same desk, in front of the same screen, and they hand him a piece of paper.
Oh, we've just heard that police have detained the man they wish to interview in connection with the jewel robbery.
Within the next 20 seconds, the Eric Idle on the background projector comes back, and Eric Idle in the foreground says,
they say, however, that acting on his information, they now wish to interview a newsreader in the central London area.
So, like, it picks up pretty quickly.
Mm-hmm.
The one thing I wish they could have done, but it just may have been too technically difficult to do, is I wish the projector film was one continuous take.
Mm.
But you can tell they do have an edit there, probably just for simplicity or they ran out of time.
I'd say for timing.
Yeah. I mean, their timing was very spot on.
Yeah.
And that's a pretty complicated thing to get, where you're basically getting your cue off of something you can't see. You just have to know the cadence and the rhythm and the timing and boom, okay, now I move. You also have the hand handing in the letter.
Right.
Which prompts him. And then, of course, Graham Chapman coming in as a policeman and whisking him away. That's all very tricky to do. And still within a minute, it's tight, concise, and it packs a punch. I love it. Is there anything that I may have left out that you want to talk about in your favorite sketch list?
I do want to talk a little bit about the customs agent sketch, because I don't think it's going to come up in my five moments. Is it going to come up in yours?
No.
Then, yeah, let's talk about it briefly before we move on to the Python Minute.
Anything to declare?
Yes. No, 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 nothing to declare, no. Nothing in my suitcase, no.
I think that the tension in that sketch is interesting. The escalation of Palin's performance of a nervous man getting increasingly revealed that he is definitely a smuggler.
Which country have you been visiting, sir?
Switzerland. Oh, no! Not Switzerland. Not Switzerland. Began with S, but wasn't Switzerland. Oh, what could it be? Terribly bad memory for names. What's the name of that country where they don't make watches at all?
It's extremely broad comedy, but I enjoy it. I especially enjoy the escalation of the suitcase and the alarms going off. The audience also finds that to be pretty good, despite the fact that it's very clearly a sound that's just being played in the studio and doesn't feel like it's coming from the suitcase at all. But there are a couple of moments in that sketch. One where John Cleese talks about the sketch as they're doing it and says,
that came out a bit glib, didn't it?
That it's too writerly and therefore not believable is interesting, particularly in contrast with the performances that each of them is giving. I feel like the sketches in this particular episode tend to be concept to punchline sketches in a way in which we don't associate with Monty Python. The customs agent sketch ends with a quick reversal of them then accusing a vicar of being a smuggler and letting the actual smuggler go. The raid ends with, blimey, what did I give to the wife?
The job interview sketch ends with, oh, we filled that job weeks ago.
Right. They're all very clear, contained sketches that don't actually need the kind of animation slash insert kernel, insert the Vox Pops letter writing connective tissue. All of which gives the episode a different quality of than the other stuff that we've seen before, a slightly less anarchic nature. So I think that it's fascinating that the part that you glommed in on as one of your favorite bits is the reader response letters. The fact that the linking segment is perhaps the most zany, the most silly, the most anarchic says something about the other sketches in the episode.
One thing about the smuggler sketch that I found very difficult is that, to me, it seems like they're harping on something which was a big deal at the time.
Mm.
This is all pre-Euro Europe. Well, also, Switzerland doesn't go by the Euro, but never mind. where people were smuggling Swiss watches a lot. Enough that it would be newsworthy. Since that is no longer on the back of the tongue of people in contemporary America, that didn't really hold much weight to me. Mm. So I was just going on the performance itself, which is not bad, but I think it draws too much on, oh, well, your sticker says you're from Zurich, sir. That joke kind of doesn't hold any water for me.
Basically, the stakes don't necessarily feel real or perilous enough that you can relate to the circumstances.
Correct. I was impressed with Michael Palin's performance because he has there's a lot of fidgeting he has to do in a controlled way. By comparison, John Cleese is just kind of boring to listen to. Mm. I think that was kind of by design, but I'm not sure if he would be the right actor to do that part because it left me with this kind of like, not so excited response. It's interesting because we've already talked about the different, if you will, teams that wrote that they would have two members of dissimilar teams acting so directly in one sketch that was filmed or that was in studio. But it doesn't really seem to flow very well for me.
Interestingly enough, the normal cop that we would have used in those circumstances would have been Graham. But Graham's playing a cop in both the newsreader sketch and the drugs planting sketch. So it would have been over the top. If you were thinking
and
about...
He even plays the cop in this sketch. He's the one who takes off Eric Idle at the end.
And I think that the chemistry would have been interesting if you'd had Terry Jones playing the heavy in this. And it also would have been more in line with the writing team of Palin and Jones. Obviously, I don't know who wrote this sketch. But then Jones shows up immediately afterwards in A Duck, a Cat, and a Lizard. So he couldn't have done both of those things together. When you start thinking about the economics of who can play what versus who wrote what, it does occasionally mean that perhaps somebody who would have led a different energy to the sketch may not have been available.
Yeah.
Well, it is now time for the Monty Python Minute, when we challenge Nathan to summarize a minute in a coherent manner. Nathan, you have said that perhaps the audience wouldn't necessarily enjoy your required minute and a half of trying to come up with something interesting to say about a minute that perhaps we've already talked about. So we've adapted. I mean, 5 episodes in, but we're changing the format of the show, ladies and gentlemen. We have gone to random.org.
Due to all of your endless letters being written into us that you could not have written because you've never heard it yet.
That's right. That's right. The lovely people at random.org have given us a minute, and I have compiled a number of trivia questions equal to the minute that you will be commenting on. So after your 30-second summary of watching a minute from the episode, I am going to try and have you answer that many questions in a minute. So we're still going to keep the high-tension speed round momentum of the Monty Python Minute, and you don't know whether you will have to answer one question in a minute or 28 questions in a minute, and whether or not this will be a ludicrous task in its success or failure. Are you ready?
Well, the good news is you don't know either.
So, you've got your DVD all queued up. You're ready to watch.
All right, give me the minute.
The good people at random.org have decreed that you will be watching Minute 11. That's Minute 11.
Wouldn't buy 2,000 clocks!
People do. Now, close your one. Move along, please. Go on. Don't waste our time. We're out there. We'll catch the real smugglers.
I am a real smuggler!
All right, Nathan, you have 30 seconds to summarize Minute 11 of Monty Python's Flying Circus, Episode 5, starting now.
Michael Palin has been outed as a smuggler, but he doesn't get taken seriously by the customs agent played by John Cleese, and so within short order, he's he's asked to leave because he's just causing a line, and then Eric Idle comes in as a vicar, and within 3 seconds gets basically mauled by John Cleese, saying that he is a smuggler, and he's got to get into the room and stripped. And then it transitions to Terry Jones and a panel program where he has stuffed lizard, duck, and a lizard, duck, and a cat. And, yeah.
All right. That was hard.
Exercise in futility.
That was hard, but this will be even harder.
This has a transition between two things, but the things are related, so.
And now,
yes,
you have a minute to answer 11 trivia questions about this episode, sourced in part by Kim Howard Johnson's And Now for Something Completely Trivial, the Monty Python Trivia and Quiz Book. We've scoured it for a question specifically about this episode, and we're going to see how many out of 11 you can get correct in 60 seconds. Are you ready?
So this is from the episode or just from this
minute? From this episode. Not just for the minute. I was not able to come up with 11 questions related to just those 60 seconds of footage.
Okay, more fine print here. Does this minute include you reading all of the questions?
Yes.
All right, so read fast. Okay.
Which of the three is not in Confuse a Cat? Long John Silver, Napoleon, Mr. Gumby?
Mr. Gumby.
Who played Sandy Camp?
Eric Idle.
What is the name for the discussion panel featuring the cat, the duck, and the lizard?
Issues today. I don't know.
It doesn't have one.
Okay.
Sandwiches? Blimey! Whatever did I give the wife is said by what character?
That is Police Constable Pan Am.
Police Constable Harry Thatcher. How does the Confuse-a-Cat link to an animated woman being packed into a suitcase?
John Cleese's mustache.
Correct. How many other times does Eric Idle appear nude in Monty Python's Flying Circus aside from Confuse-a-Cat?
He is nude with the previous Katiawaya scene.
How many pages in Charles Atlas's gigantic free muscle bounding course?
1,000.
78. Well,
is that it?
That's all we were able to get through.
Crap.
So that means we got through 7 out of 11, and you got 1, 2, 4.
I got 2 right.
You got 3 or 4 right, depending. You definitely got 3 right. And I'm going to give you a half point for realizing that Harry Thatcher was a police constable and remembering his rank, considering that I got the fact that the general was a sergeant major wrong previous episode. I feel like you deserve a half a point. So congratulations on 3.5 out of 11.
Now, before we were doing a minute and a half summary of the importance of that 1 minute.
Yeah.
Would it not be fair to have this be a 90-second bit versus just 1 minute?
Interesting question.
It'll be sent to the committee for review.
I'm just saying, if the segment is being called the Monty Python Minute, to give you a minute and a half to answer questions, I don't think it's on message. You should have had slightly less than 6 seconds to hear and answer each question. I feel like that is right on the edge of fair and deeply unfair at the same time.
So when I get them wrong, you don't always say what the right answer is.
It's true.
How many times has Eric Idle been naked?
Twice.
So twice other than that sketch?
So once other than that sketch.
Oh, that was the Jerusalem from Al Searching Time.
He plays a nude cricket bowler in a sketch that's name I did not write down because it's far in the future. Other questions that we didn't get to. There are more people named Ken or Arthur than anything else in Monty Python's Flying Circus. John Cleese's letter to the BBC, is he a Ken or an Arthur?
He's Arthur.
He is. He's Brigadier Arthur Gormanstrop. What's the lowest score given by the judges in the management training course interview?
67.
6.7. Congratulations. That's amazing. I wish we'd gotten to that one. And how many times does Terry Jones shush Michael Palin in Confuse a Cat?
Oh, good Lord. 7 times.
5.
How much of those were from the book and how much of those were your own creation?
I wrote the last 5. The first 5 were in the book.
So I got to 2 of yours.
You got the Charles Atlas one was the first one by me.
Okay. 78 pages. In my mind, I knew it was small, but it's like, but it's a book that essentially crushes him.
Right.
And it's huge.
Right. But I think part of Gilliam's point is that the Charles Atlas, in order to bulk you up, really, there isn't all that much you can talk about. And also, Charles Atlas is probably not a man of many letters. Please don't sue us, the estate of Charles Atlas.
And so now we're going to talk about our top five moments. These are things that were just very brief on screen, cartoon, linking bit, acting bit, you name it, that just make us smile and chuckle every time we see it. So Ben, give me a top five moment.
Well, since we were just talking about the follow-up to the customs agent sketch.
To consider the moral problems raised by the law enforcement methods involved, we have a duck, a cat, and a lizard.
A duck, a cat, and a lizard is a very fascinating sketch to me because I think it's predicated on camera position. When you watch the episode, Jones is shot in extreme close-up, but that wouldn't have been the experience of the studio audience that laughs at it. When it eventually cuts back to a reveal of him with the animals in the chairs around him, that's what they would have been seeing the whole time. And I do wonder about the direction choices that led to feeling like the extreme close-up on Jones was the best way to create the comic atmosphere for the televised version of that sketch. However, what does work about it, therefore, is when it does cut to each of the individual stuffed animals in a chair, they are bizarre and weird. And the final reveal of the cat, which has these weird-ass staring glass eyes, never fails to make me laugh. It's almost the very definition of moment, too. So I feel particularly good about leading our conversation with that particular one.
Okay. Number two.
Hit me.
We brought it up already, so I'm going to say it now. Graham Chapman's overacting in Confuse the Cat.
Mm.
It's our cat. He doesn't do anything. He just sits out all there on the lawn.
Is he dead?
Oh. Oh. Thank God for that. For one ghastly moment, I thought I was too late.
Great timing, great physicality, his almost overly tightly contained energy, which is, it's subdued, but you can tell it's very intense, and his gesticulations to have them sit down, and all that just gets a laugh from the audience and gets a laugh from me. Mm. It's one of these things where physical comedy is hard to put into words, but he embodies those very specific choreographed moves so tightly, incorporating the timing so perfectly that it's funny. It's only a brief moment on screen, but I do like watching him in those kind of roles.
I like that Chapman, who studied to be a doctor, plays the veterinarian with all the arrogance and class surety of a medical doctor when he's consulting with this couple in New Esher. That, I believe, is the linchpin to his performance and to the funniness of it, is that he walks into their house but treats it like his surgery. He has an amazing arrogance of just assuming that everyone will treat him with respect. But let's point out, he's a cat doctor. And yet, however, the couple still responds to him like he deserves every ounce of ego that he wears very much on his sleeve.
Super. You have a number three?
I do. I will go with, speaking of Graham, in the beginning of the smuggler sketch, it starts out as a link from the previous Vox Pops with Eric Idle talking about how important customs agents are. And then it has Graham knocking on the door.
Well, I think customs people are quite necessary, and I think they're doing quite a good job, really. Door's open.
Oh, yeah.
The knocking goes on for several seconds, loud and insistent and annoying, and his lunatic performance of a corrupt cop is very, very odd. Do we have a moment to delve into, speaking of moments, do we have a moment to delve into what Daryl Larson in The Utterly Complete, Thoroughly Unillustrated Guide to All the References talks about with this particular sketch?
Go for it. We can do anything.
It's true. So he points out that this is potentially a composite reference to celebrity arrests in 68 and 69. Where John Lennon was arrested for drug possession, and Lennon claimed that he was framed by a police officer named Sergeant Norman Pilcher. George Harrison was similarly arrested by Pilcher and also claimed to have been framed. And in 69, Mick Jagger also had his flat tossed for drug possession. And a different detective, Sergeant Robin Constable, was accused of planting the drugs on Jagger and then asking for a bribe. So rock musicians in this exact contemporary period were very much being targeted by the police, at least according to their stories. The police agency refused to admit that these were frame jobs, although some of them ended up coming out in court that they had been. So this is very much based on current events in an interesting way. Therefore, the decision to play the part of the police officer in such a broadly buffoonish way is interesting. I don't know that when I'm watching the sketch, and I don't know how much contemporary audiences would have keyed into the fact that he's clearly such an idiot. However, when he says several times,
"Oh, oh, 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 there is a brown paper bag I have found on the premises."
After he's planted the drugs on the table, it's wonderful. He's really good at being a dumb, bad acting in both ways of the phrase police constable. And the additional frisson of knowing that there's a good chance that the audiences would have known that this was a thing that was happening intrigues me.
Contrast Graham's performance with Eric Idle, who is the actor who plays a very straight character, who even starts out the sketch essentially congratulating the customs officers in England at the time.
Right. Basically saying, it's a good thing we have law enforcement.
I'm curious that there is a real police officer whose name was Sergeant Robin Constable.
Right.
It's like, it's like a dentist named Crentist.
He must have been very glad to get promoted to the rank of detective sergeant. Would have sucked when he was constable. What's your number four moment, Nathan?
I'm just titling this as Erotic Film Incoherence.
Ha ha! Oh, I'm glad you brought this one up.
So once again, we have Terry Jones getting naked. He is the most easily undressable Python member. He does it quite a lot, actually. But yeah, there he is making out with Carol Cleveland. And I know there's some bits about Eric Idle's character coming in and sort of breaking the scene.
I'm terribly sorry. It's not, in fact, match of the day. It is, in fact, edited highlights of tonight's romantic movie. Sorry.
I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about the films that they put on as metaphors for sex. Mm-hmm. Things like watching a brick smokestack filmed falling down but being projected in reverse so that it's actually getting more erected. The obvious phallic symbols, they're funny, and I will also say that they were reused about 22 years later to great effect in The Naked Gun 2.5, The Smell of Fear, with almost the same exact things. Trains going into tunnels, rockets launching, fountains sprouting.
I have both those lists in front of me, actually. So in the Monty Python's Complete All the Words, Volume 1, we have the following. Collapsing factory chimney in reverse motion. Pan up tall soaring poplars in the wind. Waves crashing. Fish in shallow water. Fountains. Exploding fireworks. Lava bursting out of a volcano. Rocket taking off. Express train going into tunnel. Dam bursting. Battleship broadside. Lion leaping through flaming hoop. Richard Nixon's nose. Milking a cow, planes refueling in midair, and then the Women's Institute applauding before the lead shot of the tower collapses back in normal motion. In Naked Gun 2.5, we actually have some, as you say, the exact same imagery. We have the dam explosion. We have a human cannonballer coming out of a cannon instead of a tiger jumping through a hoop. We have the same kind of imagery. We have fireworks. But it's slightly updated in terms of some of the anatomical stand-ins being different. I don't think they could have quite gotten away with what Naked Gun does of black liquid oil gushing from a well and an underwater torpedo being fired. I think that those visual metaphors for ejaculation may have been a little too far. Yeah, it is the exact gag and some of the same images.
So I'm pleased that the Naked Gun uses gag either unwittingly or not. Pretty hard to put your finger on them just coming up with that on their own. I think they watched that for inspiration. But I do like how this was used. Although I might say it doesn't really seem to make a whole lot of sense necessarily the order in which things go in. I guess they're implying that it's a multiple male orgasm sexual reverse. But that aside.
If that's the case, well done, Terry Jones.
Well done, Terry. Well, it is Carol Queen.
I'll close us off with the appearance of the first proto Gumby.
Well, I think that nobody's got a broad should be allowed back in the country. I mean, blimey! Blimey!
All right.
Anybody who's a fan of Monty Python is familiar with the etymology of the name Gumby, the fact that the characters wear those rubber gun boots in order to go wading, and that that's what the name is short for. And so we have John Cleese dressed in those rubber gum boots and shouting like a maniac, even though he doesn't quite yet have the Hitler mustache and the knotted kerchief on his head that will appear shortly.
Or the round-rimmed glasses or the sweater.
Right. Right. It's not a complete uniform, and therefore that leads me to believe that this is very much a specific image of a type of Englishman that they're aware of, that they are reproducing, and then moving further into him being a regular character, much in the way that the Pepper Potts are.
Mm-hmm.
But his little rant about how he should be allowed to eat a squirrel if he wants to.
I mean, be fair. I mean, I don't eat squirrels, do I? I mean, well, perhaps I do, one or two, but there's no law against that, is there? It's a free country.
I don't know. I think squirrel is a funny word. Anybody who went to a certain kind of liberal arts college is familiar with the way in which squirrels get really fat and bored by human presences and therefore don't care and don't feel threatened and don't really feel like they're part of the natural cycle of nature anymore and that and they just sort of sit around. So violence against squirrels to me is funny. And the way in which Cleese shouts violently at the idea that if he wanted to abuse a squirrel, then that would be well within his rights and prerogative. It cracks me up. I think at this point we should point out that this podcast in no way endorses animal cruelty against squirrels or any other rodents.
I like where they took this character, where he eventually gets very, much more dumbed down, where his even his way of speaking becomes a sort of caricature in its own right. With the mustache and the glasses. In a way, it's kind of they're democratizing it a little bit and taking it less reliant on Cleese's performance, but it's something they can all do if they sort of stand with their knees slightly bow-legged with their wrists curled up like they're holding some dumbbells but not actually holding anything. I like where they took the character. This particular one, I appreciate his bombastic, irascible behavior and how totally incoherent it is.
Right, just the way in which he can't even form sentences. He's so angry.
What I feel doesn't work about this, just because I don't want to say it, is I feel like it ends a little bit on a whimper. Maybe it's Terry Gilliam dressed in the knight's costume, carrying the rubber chicken. It's a character who's been in at least three other episodes previous to just thwack whoever it is on screen with a rubber chicken across the head.
With an actual chicken. With a plucked, dead, actual chicken.
Really?
I mean, I'll be honest. I'm looking forward to when the cleaned up Blu-rays show up on my front stoop and I get a chance to rewatch these in brilliant HD. There's something about the way in which it has limply sagged in his hands that has led me to believe that that is a real chicken and not a rubber chicken. I know he's often referred to as the rubber chicken knight, but I think it's real.
Getting hit over the face with the real dead chicken. Crunchy, raw, real dead chicken.
Everyone's favorite day out. But yeah, you're not wrong that it doesn't end with... It ends with a limp, damp, non-rubber chicken in the stomach as opposed to on a strong note. But, no, I just like the word squirrels. I'm going to concentrate my moment on those lines and forget the rest of them. Forget the rest of the vox pop. It's a moment, damn it.
All right. Oh my gosh, what do we do now? It's about time, right?
We need an animation that links us to the... Or a letter that links us to the final parts of the show.
This episode of The Python Perspective was conceived, researched, performed, and most likely edited by Ben Russell and Nathan Emily. Sound design also by the two of us.
Our logo was designed by Liana Emily. Thank you, Liana. The theme song is by John Philip Sousa. Thank you, John. And sourced by the Creative Commons clips that were available on the archive.org community. Thank you, archive.org.
You can find us at pythonperspective.com and follow us on Twitter and Instagram at PythonPod. This podcast is an intellectual exploration of the comic phenomenon, known as Monty Python's Flying Circus.
There are things, dates, facts, corporations, Charles Atlases, and data of any kind that you feel are incorrect. Please contact us via the website, and we'll post it to our errata page on pythonperspective.com as soon as possible.
Again, our, if you want to call it a discussion, great, is purely in the name of academic interest and contributing to the common conversation. I'm Nathan. My co-host is Ben.
Richard Nixon's nose is very funny.
We'll see you next time we try not to think about Dick Nixon when we discuss Episode 6, It's the Arts, or the BBC entry to the Zinc Stout of Budapest.